Evening, Black Urban America. Again, good evening, Black Urban America. My name is Kenny Jones. How are you this evening? We have another week, and this is my weekly show, Black Urban America. Just want to take care of some things. Black Urban America come on every Tuesday evening from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also, Professor Collette, please call back at 909-265-9215. Okay, here she go. On Saturday evenings, we have a call to sleep with provocative thought. That's also at 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Returning on June 28th, Wednesday, from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., we have Devlin Heflin with No One Talks. Also, we have a new program, the Marketing Partnership Program, where we help small business owners and people that are self-employed and entrepreneurs and help them to have their products and services exposed to the United States of America. Tonight's guest is Professor Melanie Collette, and she airs out the state of New Jersey. And she is a professor in the computer science at Rowan University. And also, she is the vice president or former vice president of the New Jersey Federation of Republican Women. Good evening, Professor Collette.
Good evening, current vice president. I was just sworn in about a month ago.
Oh, of course. I read X. I know what X means former. Oh, so they reinstated her.
I understand. You know what? I need to go in and update my information. So I was former first vice chair, you know, so many titles, but I was just sworn in about a month ago as vice president.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Retaining your spot. And so tonight, I guess I'm going to ask you some questions about our current president, President Donald Trump, and some of the policies that he is trying to implement in Congress and the Senate, and how these policies will affect our African-American community, specifically in the urban communities.
First, the first
issue I would like to address is the school choice. I know Betty DeVos is the Secretary of Education, and she's a big advocate for school choice. Now he's trying to provide additional federal investment of $20 billion in this educational sphere. How would that affect my Black community? If I'm a parent, I got a grown child, but if I had small children, what have you, what would that do for me living in the areas of East New York, in Brooklyn, Compton, in L.A., Houston, certain parts of Atlanta? How would that affect me and my community and my family?
Now, as you may or may not be aware, I know you've looked at my background. I've worked in both public and private schools. I worked in the private. I worked the private school area as an executive assistant, and part of my job was to monitor and manage the budget. And so I saw how money was spent in the private sector, in the private school sector, which of course would be one of the school choices that you have.
Right.
I've also worked in the public school as a public school teacher. I actually just resigned from my last public school teaching job a couple of months ago. So I have a fair amount of experience in both entities over the last 20 years or so. And what I can tell you, and I'm a huge advocate of school choice, and what I can tell you is that for African Americans and those schools who are, that are poorly performing, that school choice is what you want to put money into, in my opinion. You don't want kids who are stuck inside schools that are not performing well, specifically children who are interested in learning. You don't want them to be distracted by, you know, students who are not interested in learning, to put it kindly. They only get one opportunity for their education. So while, you know, the unions and everyone else are arguing about what it is that they should be doing to improve schools, those kids are withering away, and their educations are being wasted. They only have one opportunity, one shot to get it. So if those parents can have the opportunity to send their kids somewhere else to homeschool their children or to send them to another district, then I say by all means, open that opportunity up. So that's my position.
Okay. Well, how would that help the failing public schools? If the public school is failing, how will school choice, putting in $20 million and $20 billion into school choice, and at the same time, he's cutting education by 13.5%. How does that help? I'm a product of public school education. I know public school education in this country needs to be revamped. I know this. I know public school education needs to be improved. But a lot of school officials said that he's just diverting this $20 billion from the public sector into the private sector. And where does that leave? Where does that leave our public school schools, especially in the urban areas?
Well, respectfully, the goal is not to the goal is not to help the public schools and the teachers and the administrators. The goal is to help the kids. And so, what we need to make sure of is that the money is following the children. So, and as it does, so for example, if you have a school district where, let's just say, the amount of money that follows a child is $10,000 per child, and that child wants to go to a school that is doing better, then that $10,000 would go to that school district along with that child who is academically performing. If that child has to worry about whether or not they're gonna be robbed or worse, or whether or not they're going to be able to concentrate on their studies and they earnestly want to learn, I absolutely think that that child, along with that child's tax dollars, should go to another school. Now, what happens to that school and the students that are remaining there, I know that this may absolutely sound harsh, but if those children are not there to learn and they're there to victimize, are there to learn, I have no problem with turning it into a reform school or into whatever it is that's going to turn into. My concern is for the children who want to learn. And for the children
you mean to tell me you want to take a public school K through 8, and turn this, instead of trying to improve the academics and the performance of these children, just take the brightest out of that school, send to a magnet school or a charter school or a private school, and leave these other kids behind, and turn them into future criminals? Because that's what reform schools do. They're just a school for.
That's right. And I'm going to explain to you why. Because as someone who has taught in the classroom with children of all different backgrounds and academic competencies, and also different enthusiasm about their education. I can tell you exactly what happened. The kids who have less academic enthusiasm bring down the kids who don't. That's what happened. Now, I have no problem with partnering with the private sector to develop some kind of program to help those students step up to deal with the challenges that they are dealing with at home, whether it's a drug-addicted parent or poverty or whatever it is, to help them meet the standard. But what I certainly will not support is having those other children suffer on behalf of somebody else's family problem. That I will not co-sign, because it's not fair to them. Nobody ever thinks about it being fair to them. Why should they have to suffer? Because of somebody else's mistake. Why should they have to be tortured every single day going to school? I don't think they should.
What type of mistakes? What type of mistakes are they suffering under?
I'll give you a perfect example. If you have a classroom, and this is from an actual experience of mine, you have a classroom full of 25 students, for example, and you have three that are on something called no credit status, meaning now they're at a point in the school year where they care so little about their grades that they have no possibility of passing. Now, many times students who are in those situations have all kinds of issues at home and reasons why they are in that situation. And don't get me wrong, I feel for those students. I absolutely do. I know that you're probably thinking, oh, my gosh, he's an evil Republican who doesn't care about those kids. But I actually do.
I'm not saying that, Professor.
Your listeners are probably thinking that.
I'm not thinking that. I'm just trying to understand the positioning.
Well, I'm going to tell you. I'm telling you, as somebody who's a real-world example, as someone who's been in the classroom, been there, done it. This is how it happens. So you have three students who are on no credit status, okay? Meaning there is absolutely nothing they can do to pass the class point. That can literally happen halfway through the school year. So they're coming to class every day with no possibility of passing. And like I said, granted, there's probably all kinds of socioeconomic, domestic reasons why those students are in that situation, and I will give you that. At the same time, the students that are in my class, the other students that want to learn, are being distracted by their behavior because they don't care about their grades. I'm having to give them extra attention. I'm having to make phone calls that are completely unnecessary because they have no possibility of passing. So I'm completely wasting my energy when I can be spending it on kids who need to learn. It's a matter of resources, is what I'm saying. And listen, so that's what I'm trying to say to you, that the other students who legitimately want to learn are suffering under those circumstances. And so, that's the fundamental problem that I have. And as someone who has seen it firsthand, who has seen my entire class suffer because I spent more time in my class disciplining three students than actually teaching my class, now the class is behind. I didn't get to one segment of my lesson because I spent, 15 minutes of a 40-minute class dealing with these three students. The rest of my class has suffered now. So that's the reality that many people, many teachers, and many bureaucrats don't talk about because they don't know, because they haven't spent any time on the front line, as I have. But that's real talk about how that goes down. And I've never been in a really bad school. I can't imagine what it's like in a truly horrific school. I've been very fortunate to be in some pretty good school, but for what teachers deal with in the inner city, it is no wonder that the kids are failing with what they have to deal with. And why should those kids who earnestly want to learn have to suffer through that?
Well, Professor Collette, I feel that all children wants to learn. I think all children wants to do well in school, but the limited resources and the fundings to our communities are so limited, and with these cuts, if the resources and funding gonna be more limited, I think not only does it frustrate the child, it frustrates the family, it frustrates the community. Now, I'm just saying, how come...
May I have to get a little feedback on that?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. I just finished my thought, but go right ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go right ahead. I'm not going to come back to it. Go ahead.
You kind of presented the cut and them not having enough money as fact, and that's just not respectfully steeped in reality. You know, because I was someone who dealt with the money at a private school, I saw how much less money private schools actually dealt with per pupil and how much more they did. The problem in public schools are the entities that have their hands in the bench. That's what the problem is. It's not the amount of money. It's the people who are taking the money. That's the issue. Public schools, particularly inner city schools, have plenty of money. That's not the issue. It's what they're doing with it. It's the waste and abuse. It is, you know, paying teachers that shouldn't be paid, tenured teachers that have no business in the classroom. The union, don't even get me started.
I'll get you started. What about the teachers union? I had dealt with the teachers union before. What about the teachers union? I think, hold up, some of the battles that goes on in North Philadelphia, in East New York, Compton, Atlanta, Baltimore, I mean, some of these teachers are really fighting behind the eight ball, as I can use that as an analogy. And some of the funding, you're right, some of the funding is not trickled down to the student. But if you look at the materials that these students have to work with, don't you know in some public school system that there are students that have to share a book?
And you know what?
Maybe if you take half of that $20 billion and instead of cutting the educational budget by 13.5%, just maybe if you really, since he called, he knows everything, and really examine some of the fallouts from this. Maybe instead of cutting that budget, maybe to get some of these actual resources in the classroom.
Or perhaps if instead of throwing more money at it, they went and examined all of the waste, fraud, and abuse, starting number one with the teachers' union that are continually giving teachers raises without performing. That's number one. It's thousands of dollars every year. They demand automatic raises. You can't fire anybody. Let me tell you something. I worked in a private school for 14 years. I had a year-to-year contract. I never had one problem with job security. Not one. The minute I became a public school teacher, because I thought I could be more effective in the classroom, so I decided to become a public school teacher, and I had to deal with the union. I thought, you know what? I don't like unions philosophically, but I'm going to go ahead and give them a shot. Worst experience.
Why you don't like unions, Professor? How come you don't like unions? You know, if it wasn't for they said in the history of when they talk about the history of unions, if it wasn't for the unions, some of us would have not into the middle class back in the 50s and the 60s.
Okay, but it's 2017, so can we get an update? Now I can defend myself. I had a problem at another job. I have a lovely labor attorney who did a very nice job and handled my case very well. We have labor laws now that we didn't have back in the 1950s. The labor unions and problems that I had, guess what? Because I was non-tenured, the union would not help me because they were, quote, unquote, afraid I would get fired. Well, what do I have you for? And then if I wanted to go approach a person by myself because I'm a big girl and I'm a professional, then they wouldn't talk, the administrator wouldn't talk to me without my union rep. But yet and still, I'm paying union dues. And how about this? Maybe if I wasn't paying union dues, I could afford to pay for my health care. Maybe that. So the union, and you are paying to keep teachers in positions that they literally should not be in. There are teachers who are getting paid who are not teaching because the school district literally can't fire them. Do you know that there are districts where you can get tenure after 3 years? Do you consider yourself to have mastered anything after 3 years?
I thought it was 10 years.
No, three. 10 years, mm. 10 years in colleges, okay? But in public school, oh, no, 3 years, 5 years, then you get tenure. And you cannot get fired. And then you know what happens when you have no incentive, no intrinsic value, then you begin to call it in. That's human nature, and it just should not be. It just should not be. And that's part of your problem. So when you have that kind of economic model, when you have that kind of economic model, and not to mention the fact that what the unions do with that money is throw it behind political candidates that will continue the unions going, that will support the union, it's like a Ponzi scheme or racketeering. Almost. All they do is support candidates that are going to keep them going. But we do not need the unions. We have labor attorneys for that and labor laws. And the union did not do, I had a very unfair evaluation. I've never, and you know why? Part of it is because I'm a conservative and I got a big mouth, as I'm sure you gathered.
And, yeah.
And once you know, if you are a public school teacher and you're a conservative, you're a Republican, it's not a good position to be in. But I don't care because I like to teach. But I had a principal literally look me in my face and say, how could you be in the GOP and be a teacher? Like it was any of his business. And gave me a bad end-of-the-year review after giving me sterling teacher reviews throughout the year. But after he found out I was in the GOP, then he had a problem. And the union did nothing because I was not tenured. So what is the point? And it occurred to me, I couldn't figure it out for the longest time, right? I'm like, why would the union not help me? Isn't that their job? You know why? Because if they lose, then they lose their credibility. So what they always recommend to non-tenured teachers, and any non-tenured teacher will tell you this, is to just pull your jets and basically let them do whatever they want until you're tenured. Well, then what are you there for? With me paying you $1,500 a year. For what?
Well, let me ask you this. So do you believe in Bessie DeVos that she feels that she wants to privatize public schools? What's your thought on that?
I have not heard that she wants to privatize public schools entirely.
Yeah, I read that yesterday.
Okay, I didn't hear. She's
a big advocate for privatizing the public school system.
And what you're explaining,
maybe it's needed if the right corporations come into our community, huh?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I said, maybe it's needed, since after you explained some of the situations in our schools, maybe it's needed. Maybe it needs to be privatized. What would that look like, privatizing in public schools?
Well, I'll tell you. I think that if they were going to do that there should be a criteria that they use to decide whether or not they're going to privatize the public school. And then, obviously, and this is the biggest thing, that whatever company would be chosen, whether it's on a federal level or state level, they need to make absolutely sure that there are no conflicts of interest. There's nothing I can't stand more than, you know, some spaghetti situation where someone gets a contract because they happen to be, you know, some senator's cousin or whatever. You know, it's a bad look. It's a bad look no matter what side of the aisle you're on. That being said, if you have a school that is perpetually underperforming, then clearly there is a problem, and somebody needs to come in and do something about it. And maybe you don't privatize it entirely. Perhaps there's – maybe you just privatize the administration. Perhaps that's what you do. Instead of making them public employees, perhaps you just make the administrators public employees – excuse me, private employees.
Mm-hmm.
And do it that way. You know, maybe there's – perhaps there's creative hybrid solutions that you can come up with, which would definitely involve passing a law through Congress. But it could be done. But, you know, there are some just some really – anytime you attach money to students and learning anywhere – you're going to have a problem. And by the way, how do you think schools keep enough money in their budget if the money follows the child? Keep enough money in their budget in order to pay for all the teachers and all the raises that the union wants.
Overcrowding.
Right.
Overcrowding.
What is overcrowding?
I know some classrooms that got 35 students in the classrooms.
That's right. So, and failing, but being passed from grade to grade instead of being kicked out or sent to some type of alternative program where they can get their skills up, which I would not be opposed to, but instead they're not moving them out of the school so that they're not a distraction, like the example I gave you earlier, kids on no credit status. They're now a distraction to kids who are on I'm getting credit for this class status. You know, if you don't move those kids somewhere else, what's the incentive, do you think, for schools keeping those kids in the classroom? Going back to my scenario, that's $30,000 sitting in the classroom every day that they would lose if they simply remove those kids from the classroom. Why do they need that money? Because of the union.
So you say that what I'm getting from you say the reason why we got these failing schools in our communities are the kids that's underperforming and the teachers unions that are keeping teachers in there after 3 years of tenure, maybe 5 years of tenure, that don't have the moral investment, the emotional investment, or the culture investment to teach the children.
And there's another component. There's a final component, which is parent involvement, which is major.
Right.
Parent involvement is key. You know, kids will only treat school as serious as parents do. And if it's not important to the parents, it certainly will not be important to the kids. And that gets back to what I said earlier about, of course, the reason why, you know, I had three kids in my class on no credit status was because surely there were probably some socioeconomic and domestic reasons, things going on at home, probably reasons why those kids found themselves.
Hold for a second. Are you saying that another major reason for underperformance of public schools in the black community is the lack of parent participation and or that parents don't have that as a priority in the home?
Absolutely. Absolutely, that's what I'm saying. Absolutely.
Well, everybody wants their kids to learn, Professor. I mean, you talk about human nature.
Don't your kids, let me tell you something. I may want to lose weight, but I may also not feel like taking that jog, 3-mile jog, like I know I need to do. Okay, you may want a lot of things, but are you willing to work for it? That's the question. Kids' education, when you're a parent, and I'm full disclosure, I'm not a parent. I'm not a parent, but I had parents who cared about my education. I was very fortunate. And like I said, I've been in education for 20-some-odd years, so I've dealt with parents, and I've seen parents who cared very much about their kids' education, and I've seen parents who could give a rat's rear about their kids' education. I've seen it all over the spectrum. And I can tell you that when you have parents who care about their children's education, it makes a humongous difference. If it doesn't make a difference to those parents, it will not make a difference to the kids. It is just that simple.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. But just say that because of the school's family, the school's family, and put that, like, the parents don't care. Like, I see parents walking their children to school every morning. I even see young parents going to parent-teacher conferences. Maybe it's not 100% participation, but it's a significant number.
Let me ask
now,
you something.
I think you should add in another factor, environmental factors in our communities. The walk to school can be a troublesome walk, or it could be a adventurous walk to school, you know, because we have so many different, I guess, negative behaviors that's in some of these in some of these communities, not necessarily in the home, but outside the home, which I call environmental.
Okay, and who creates the environment?
The people. The
right.
residents
the
in that community.
The neighborhood.
Right.
So, I mean, we're kind of veering off into another topic, but who, you know, if they are responsible for what goes on in their own neighborhood, if an outsider come in and do something in their neighborhood, there would be riots and marches and everything else. But when there are people are doing things in their neighborhood, nobody says a word, but you know, they want to cry victim that they can't get their kids to school.
But I think that's starting to change. I think more and more people that are living in these urban centers are caring about their environment, are caring about their neighborhoods, are caring about how their buildings look or their homes look, and they want safe streets for their kids to play in during the summertime. They want summer programs where kids, I mean, more and more, what you call them, neighborhood gardens are starting to sprout up. I mean, I think that attitude is starting to change. And maybe we become more self-independent and not rely on some of these government assistance, we'll take more pride into it. And you just said something
Absolutely.
Significant that the conversation is starting to change. There's some other cuts I want to talk about. You know,
sure.
I know you sound like you're an expert in the education field, but maybe you could tell me, hey, anybody that's been doing something for 20 years, to me, is an expert. You may not my mother always said, you know, experience can be the best teacher. And sometimes someone that's on the front lines for 20 years, that's got to be one of our community leaders, but the thing is that sometimes we get used to the same old thing, and when someone comes with a different aspect or a different view, we might cringe because we're not used to hearing it, and that's what my show is all about. But I wanted to talk about the another. Program that has been around the black community, I'd say, like, since the early 70s, late 60s, and they talked about the community development block grant. He talked about cutting that by $3 billion nationally. In that community development block grant, he talked about eliminating home investment partnership program. Also, he talked about eliminating the Interagency Council on Homelessness and the Choice Neighborhood Programs. How would that look in our community if he get rid of $3 billion in the community development block grant and eliminate these other programs?
Now, you have to look at what he is going to replace it with, if anything.
He's not going to replace anything. I didn't hear anything or read anything about replacing any of these programs with something new.
Have you heard of?
No.
Are you familiar with him?
No.
Senator Tim Scott came out with a bill. I'm actually looking it up right now. Came out with a bill a couple of months ago to address this very thing. But what it does is it partners with private organizations to reinvest in blighted areas. And so those kinds of things address situations like that. See, the idea, here's the fundamental issue that I think happens across the aisle. The minute you start talking about cutting federal funds, people automatically...
He's from South Carolina?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The minute you start talking about cutting federal funds, people automatically assume that that means that, you know, you're leaving people in a lurch and that you're not going to come up with anything different. That the whole, you know, it's partisan. And as divided as the country is, you know, among Republicans and Democrats and liberals and conservatives, the big difference is the how we're going to do things. We're not far apart on what we would like to get done, but it's the how. So I said that to say that, you know, the Trump administration would like to see us use less federal money and more private partnerships. And what all private partnerships means is that, listen, if you invest in this neighborhood, you're going to make some money off of your investment, and the government is going to incentivize that so that in the long run, the taxpayers are not going to get a humongous hit. Also, you know, there's an awful lot of abuse in these programs, and there are multiple programs doing the same thing that creates a lot of waste. My fundamental problem with these housing programs is the breakup of the African American family, which by the way is what leads to all the other problems that we talked about in education. You know, 70% of children born to single mothers. And once they go to public housing, guess what? Dad can't be in the house. Well, if dad can't be in the house and you're living with a single mom, guess what? Your chances of not getting your education completed and ending up in poverty have increased dramatically. So it's all related, I guess is my point.
He wants to get rid of. He wants to cut HUD for 13.2%. That's $6.2 billion, and that's a whole lot of housing vouchers that help a lot of many low income families, and not only single parent families, but families that don't meet the median income.
That's true. That's absolutely true, but there also, like I said, is a whole lot of fraud and waste and abuse in those programs as well.
What are we going to replace it with if I feel that it's going to happen, if HUD is cut by $6.2 billion, what's going to happen to these families when you just eliminate the whole council on homelessness? You got more families going to be homeless, and that's going to drain other services that's provided for other residents.
So, do you think that with the job, you know, the job, the unemployment rate right now is at a 16-year low, right?
Go ahead.
Have you heard that?
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Right? It's at a 16-year low. So, do you think that the need for public housing should be quite as high if unemployment is so low?
Well, those numbers could be a little misleading just because the unemployment rate is at 16% low. Many people that's underemployed. You have many people that have part time work. They count into numbers. They might be working, but their income may not meet the standard needs.
That's true.
Because in the year 2000, it was said that a family of four. Now I give you 2000 statistics. I haven't read up on it in recent years, but in year 2000, it stated that a family of four need to make $100,000 a year to have the basic needs: home,
right,
automobile, education, food, and clothing for the child. $100,000. Now, people are not making that type of money. So
what do you mean
that's
about
where
the
HUD assistant can help these people, help folks that can't. And let me tell you another thing. With the issue of gentrification that's coming into these urban areas, and the rents are going up sky high, and how can they meet that standard of living?
I seriously think, and I'm trying to phrase this in such a way that it's not going to blow up the internet. I'm just kidding.
Go ahead. Phrase it as you want to. Don't be scared.
No,
this is Black Urban America. Tell it like it is, as Gil Noble used to say. Tell it like it is.
10% is not that big of a cut, in my estimation. And I don't think that people are going to be thrown out on the streets. 13% may mean you have to tighten your belt, but I would guarantee you that there is at least 13% of waste going on in that program. I can guarantee you. 13% is basically 13 cents on the dollar. You're not talking about a significant amount of money as far as the budget is concerned. And again, there in addition to that, there have been other bills put afoot, such as Tim Scott's bill that I just mentioned, to streamline the process and to offer vouchers in different ways. So just because he made a cut in one area doesn't mean that the housing problem is not addressed in another area. And I also want to point out this. Who's running HUD right now? Who's the new person in front of HUD? Who's running HUD? That's Dr. Ben Carson, right?
I thought Ben Carson was running Health and Human Services. Health and Human Services under HUD, right? Dr. Carson was running Health and Human Services.
He's running HUD.
Oh, he's running HUD? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there goes the 13.2% cut.
So let me ask you something. Do you think that running HUD is harder than operating on a baby's brain? What do you think, Steve?
No, operating on a baby's brain is much difficult.
I think so. So,
it's very difficult.
You always compare things. Oh, well, it's not like it's brain surgery. We actually have a brain surgeon running HUD, literally.
Does Dr. Carson really announce? Okay, let's be honest now. Many people, about 10,000 people, are going to download this show. Let's be honest. Does Dr. Carson really know the average African American community?
Do you know, in other words, is he in touch? Do you know Dr. Carson's story?
Yes, I know Dr. Carson's story. They made a movie about it.
Okay, but do you know how he grew up? Do you know that his mother couldn't read? Do you know that? Was completely illiterate? You know that he grew up in public housing?
Yeah, I know he came from public housing. And
so
I know he got into some trouble.
How can you sit here and say that he can't relate to the black community when you grew up in public housing?
Well, let me say this. Dr. Carson is much older than I am. The way the black community was 50 years ago is not the same as the black community of today.
So being poor is different now than it was back then. Being hungry is different now than it was back then. Being in a project is different now than it was back then.
Well, I'm saying is that it's a different environment than it was 50 years ago.
The environment is more tense.
The environment is more, I'm not going to say hostile. I'm going to keep on saying it's more tense. It's a lack of care in the housing areas. That's why they're trying to restructure.
Hang on. Who's lack of care?
From the government officials, lack of care to what's going on in what we call the projects. Not every project.
What's going on in the project?
Well, there's a lot of behaviors. Well, see, that's a whole other show, and we only got 12 minutes.
So the government's responsible for the behaviors going on in the project.
They sure helped to create it.
Behaviors.
The fundamental choices that the average family from a housing area in East New York or Brownsville is very, it could be intense, and it should not be aided or trying to change. I say in the last, let's say 20, 25, 30 years, and all I'm saying, the parents in these areas are somewhat struggling to make ends meet. When your priority is food, shelter, and what you're going to put on your children's back, you know, it'll give you enough time to think about anything else.
You do have time to think about behaving badly in your own neighborhood. Not every
family from the project is a bad, it's a negative family under certain circumstances.
But the few bad actors that are there get a safe haven. But let a cop come in there.
Not always. They do not get it. Let me tell you something. I have seen this with my own eyes. There are residents in that housing community that will dress the negative behavior by one person or one family that's going to bring the building down. I have seen that with my own eyes. Hey, I'm running out of time. Professor Collette, we're going to have a chance to continue the conversation.
I'm sure.
yes, we're gonna have a chance, and it's been a very stimulating conversation, and I will be in touch to see if we could schedule you, and it'll probably be something if you're available during the summer. You know, maybe you'll come back in a month or two, and we could have another talk about Trump. God knows our president is going to do something that is going to raise our eyebrows.
Oh, I'm sure of that, if nothing else.
Professor Collette, you could. I am going to correspond with you, and I really thank you for coming on the show. Again, I'm going to reach out to you so you can come back in sometime during the summer so we could go over some other issues. I didn't even get halfway through the questions I was going to ask you.
It happens sometimes. You know, I have my own show. Do you mind if I plug it real fast?
Huh?
I have my own show. Do you mind if I plug it real fast?
Sure. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, my fault. Give everybody your name and your website. Well, everybody's going to know your name. Your website and your show. And you know what? You're not inviting me on to your show. Oh, you're scared to say, I'm not scared to have a conservative on my show, but you're scared to have a revolutionary person on yours?
Do I sound scared?
Huh? Say what?
Do I sound scared? No.
No, you don't.
No. As a matter of fact, we definitely need to talk about that. The name of the show is Money Talk with Melanie. It is on SHR Media and High Plains Pundit Talk Radio. You can click on it on shrmedia.com, or you can also get it on Facebook, YouTube, Pinterest, and anywhere there's social media. You can find Money Talk with Melanie, your business diva. That's it. 10:05 Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the standard time. There you go.
Oh, Wednesdays and Friday. So you have a show coming on tomorrow. Okay,
Monday,
I'll probably try to catch the Friday show and everything because I have more time to catch the Friday show than Wednesday show. I'm definitely going because I saw a bunch. Well, I know you got your hands in a little bit of everything, but again, I have to sign out. But again, Professor Collette, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Okay. Well, that's another week, ladies and gentlemen, and a very stimulating conversation, another view. She brought up some very interesting points, and we're about to get into a discussion in my area about the social condition, because that's my thing, the social condition of our communities. But we need to really start tracking and start getting interested in the political atmosphere. That how something major is going to trickle down to our neighborhoods. Like I said, as always, maybe we should start thinking about self-independence, relying on our own resources, and helping our own selves, because we cannot continue to rely or government resources, and maybe we start investing our own money in our own schools, and we can have our own curriculum and teach our children, and maybe we take more pride in the education. Well, that's it for this week. As always, I am because we are because I am. Good night.